The First Amendment of the United States says, in the very beginning, Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof. Now, historically, the Establishment Clause was understood to mean that the founders intended there would be no national denomination, no Church of America like there was the Church of England. But in jurisprudence and some of the Supreme Court decisions, especially in the beginning in the 1940s, 50s, 60s with the school prayer cases and so forth, there was a different understanding. And instead, the idea of the Establishment Clause is that there's a separation of church and state, not just the institution of the church and the state, but in some ways, the influence of the church on the state. We're going to talk about all this with David Gibbs III, who is a prominent attorney. He's the founder and president of the National Center for Life and Liberty. David, it's great to have you on the program. Thanks for joining us.
Oh, Jerry, it's always my delight and look forward to talking with you.
Okay. I'm Jerry Newcomb. This is Vocal Point. And David, let's get right to it. What do you think the founders intended by the Establishment Clause?
Well, Jerry, I think you articulated it very well, that there was never an intention, as we have readjusted our thinking on this, both through the courts and through the culture, to fully remove God or any references to the Bible or religion from our government. They had come from England, and I think it's very important that you understand the context of what they were facing, where, in a sense, the Church of England, while not a political party and not even really a branch of government, but had a lot of official authority through its status as the official religion. And the idea in the United States when this country was founded by our founders was they wanted a plurality. They wanted to have a nation where different faiths, different backgrounds, different individuals would be able to freely follow after God, follow after their conscience, and they understood that there would be diversity. And so they made it very clear that we were not going to establish a religion, we weren't going to have a state church, but that we were going to then protect what they called the free exercise thereof. Now, what's kind of interesting, and this is where courts and lawyers wrestle with these issues, is there's a certain tension between the two. Everything that you do to allow someone to freely exercise their faith, if it has any government overture or government imperature on it, the thought is, well, is that being done to establish religion? And so courts are always caught with the balance. But when you look at the history, you look at tradition, you look at the intention of the founders, it was clearly understood that they were just not going to allow a state church to be established. And you can see this with their practices. I mean, there were churches meeting in the Congress. There was a litany of prayers. They prayed in Jesus' name. I mean, it was fully understood that the identity of faith and the belief in God was going to be a key part. Even Washington, when he was sworn in as president, requesting that the Bible be brought over and it being revered as part of the English common law and one of the cornerstones of this nation, there was never the intention to totally strip or make the government absolutely secular with no reference to God or his authority.
And we've gotten to the point now, you've actually said this to me one time in an interview, you said, what is the established religion of America at any given point according to the Supreme Court? And you said, well, basically it's according to whatever the Supreme Court says at that particular juncture of time, which is weird because sometimes, you know, we've gone through very strict secularist type Supreme Court reigns, like the Earl Warren time and so forth, where they just stripped away, you know, it's no school prayer, you know, can't have the Bible, you know, all that. And then later on, Warren Burger, some of the decisions made when he was Chief Justice were also bad. I mean, I think the worst one, the single worst one as far as religion and the courts was the Stone v. Graham 1980. Where they said the Ten Commandments couldn't be shown in the school because they said if the Ten Commandments were posted in the school, the children might read them, meditate them, venerate them, and obey them. And it's like, whoa, you know, and by the way, they went on to say, you know, however we might want that as an outcome, it is, you know, an affront on the Establishment Clause, something to that effect. It violates the Establishment Clause. Let's begin with just that case itself, the Stone v. Graham and the, you know, just what I just quoted, how outrageous that they would say that. The founders, I don't think, would ever have said anything like that.
Oh, not at all. I mean, the founders would have all known the Ten Commandments, believed the Ten Commandments, and to the best of their ability, practiced the Ten Commandments. And I think it's important to remember that American law, American jurisprudence, goes back to the English common law. And Jerry, you're obviously very scholarly in these matters, but the common law was basically a Bible-based law that had been passed down for hundreds of years through predominantly England, but even around the world. And their understanding of reliance on the common law was that, you know, number one, it was well known. It was the common law. It was understood. But it was also authoritative. It was based on something that they believed in, which was the authority and order of Scripture. So when you say the Ten Commandments really are the cornerstone of American law, that's an absolutely historically truthful statement. Plus, I realize with COVID and other things, visiting some of the sites is more difficult. But if you can go in and see the Supreme Court where they sit, right above them, they call it the frieze, but it's stone across the top. And Moses and the Ten Commandments is etched in the stone. And I always have found, like when you take a Stone v. Graham or any of these Ten Commandments cases, the irony of arguing those cases before justices with Moses and the Ten Commandments etched in the stone over the top. And so it's definitely been a drift. When the courts, and you mentioned the 40s and 50s, and they began misinterpreting correspondence, you know, Jefferson's letter and the wall of separation, they started creating a jurisprudence to secularize or change America. And what you and I discussed earlier is 100% correct. Religion and what is allowed really depends on the Supreme Court you have at any given time. That's why it's become so contentious in this country with who is president and who has the authority to appoint a Supreme Court justice, and then going through the Senate, what used to be a perfunctory approval, you know, is this person capable, is this person honorable, do they have a good resume, which just about every candidate that would be nominated by a president would qualify, to where now it's become highly partisan, and they almost try to guess as to how a justice will rule. And I think a lot of Americans don't understand that. You know, they will say, what is the law, or how do we uphold the law, or what is constitutional, not understanding how fluid it has become because we've moved away from the old standards of the English common law, and we very much have a legal system where from Supreme Court to Supreme Court, whether it's a Stone v. Graham with the Ten Commandments or any other case, so much of it is in their hands. As we're even looking now with Roe v. Wade being reviewed by the court, you know, there's many that say we must look to what the founding fathers intended. Others say, no, we need to, you know, let the prior precedents, Roe v. Wade, control. And it's really unknown as to what the Supreme Court will actually do, because one justice can vote one way and literally swing the whole future in that area of law. So the Supreme Court has incredible, way more power than was ever intended under our Constitution.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. In fact, I would refer people on that point to Federalist Number 81 by Alexander Hamilton, showing that the founders actually, they intended the Supreme Court to be the weakest of the three branches of government. Now, in some ways,
no question,
you know, is this the more stronger branch? But let me ask you this.
Well,
yeah, go ahead.
Before you jump on that, let me add, I think they have become the most powerful, and I'll tell you why. Their decisions are impossible to overturn except by themselves. I mean, so absent, I guess, going out and having a constitutional amendment, which is incredibly difficult to do, there is no way to overturn a ruling of the Supreme Court other than through the court itself. The president can be overturned by Congress. The Congress has votes, and the president has veto power, and there's different things. And they both can be overturned by the court. But in no instance can the president say, you know what, I don't like that Supreme Court decision, I think I'm going to overturn it, or the Congress. So the Supreme Court, in that measure, while they only deal with, say, 100 cases a year, they do have incredible power in the fact that they're the ones that review and make their own decisions.
That's interesting, because historically, I mean, there was a situation in the early 1820s or 30s or whatever, where Andrew Jackson famously said, John Marshall has made his decision, John Marshall being the Chief Justice, now let him enforce it. In other words, I'm the executive
Correct.
Of the executive branch, the doers, and the courts, they just make decisions, but, you know, I'm not going to enforce that decision. And by the way, in that particular case, it was a very bad thing that Jackson did, because that was involved in initiating the Trail of Tears, you know, where Native Americans were mistreated unjustly by the American government, and it was a really tragic thing. But I think that's interesting that historically, it wasn't understood that the courts would have all this power. I mean, that's just, I guess, another way of saying the same thing.
Well, I think there was clearly the thought of the founders was that, you know, the Congress was to be the most powerful because they managed the money and they were significantly elected by the people. The president, because of the executive function and being kind of the face of the nation, would have a lot of authority. And I think the Supreme Court was deemed, honestly, to be kind of the resolver of disputes between the states. Like if the one Supreme Court of, let's say, Virginia ruled and the Supreme Court of Maryland ruled differently, that there was a court to kind of almost arbitrate. And we learn about it in school, but I don't think we fully realize the significance of when the first justice went ahead and proceeded to grab what they called judicial review. This was a John Marshall power play in 1803 in the key case of Marbury versus Madison. He was able to put the court in this incredibly powerful position. And sadly, it's only grown. And as we moved away from more standards and expectations in our law, and as we've become more polarized, the power of the court has only increased. And so, you know, you look at the fact that the justices are appointed for life. So, you know, they're not looking for reelection. I mean, congressmen are every 2 years. Senators have a longer term, but I mean, they're constantly in a reelection phase. The president, you know, 2 4-year terms potentially. So when you look at the lifetime specter and the authority, there's no question that the Supreme Court has an awesome authority that was never fully intended by the founders.
All right. Now, going back to the First Amendment itself, sometimes lost in the, the jurisprudence related to the Establishment Clause is the second part of the religion phase or phrase of within the First Amendment, and that is the free exercise. Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof. And a lot of times these so-called establishment cases do indeed infringe, it would seem to me, on the person's free exercise rights of religion. It's as if, you know, some teacher at school, all of a sudden, you know, there's a big magnet in the threshold of the school. As he walks into the building, well, he just loses all of his constitutional rights. Certainly he can't have his free exercise of religion. We have about a minute left. Your thoughts?
Well, you've nailed it. There is definitely a tension between the two. And we've reached the point where establishment of religion jurisprudence has almost gone hostile or anti-religious and would be violative of the free exercise provision. And so there is a definite tension that is felt in all of these cases, and we definitely are pushing back for the free exercise to be more recognized, but that tension is in every one of these cases, and oftentimes it will depend on which track the court decides to go on. If they focus on free exercise, you'll win. If they focus on established religion, it will lose, and it will literally be which direction does the court choose to analyze the facts.
Okay, we have 30 seconds to close. Where do we go from here?
Well, I would encourage folks to be aware of what is in the Constitution. One of the reasons why we're losing our liberties is we don't understand what we have, and to be vocal and try to hold our elected officials accountable. And if you have any questions on these issues, we're always glad at the National Center for Life and Liberty to be a help, ncll.org.
Okay, David, thanks so much for being with us.
My privilege.